Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Before I introduce our speaker today, it's our tradition to go around the room and say our names. I'll go ahead and begin. My name is Roy.
Adam.
Greg.
Rich.
Michael.
My name is Gary.
Mark.
I'm George.
Ed.
Peter.
Francisco.
My name is Jerry.
I'm Amos.
Patrick.
I'm Tom.
Don.
Fernando.
I'm Richard.
Frank.
I'm Joe.
My name is Harley.
David.
I'm Oswaldo.
I'm Jim.
Corey.
I'm Brad.
My name is Cass. Thank you. So our speaker today is Prasada Chitta Dharmachari, who is an ordained member of the Tiratana Buddhist community. Prasada teaches meditation, yoga, and Buddhism here at the San Francisco Buddhist Center. His practice and teaching grows out of a valuing of friendship and community. He's interested in the link between ideal qualities such as love and clarity as inspiring guides, and those same qualities as they manifest imperfectly in our everyday relationships. Welcome, Prasada Chitta.
Thank you. That's interesting to hear. I think I shared that over a year ago.
So we should have updated?
I don't know. No, actually, I really like it.
Cool.
Those are very interesting things, and my I think I am interested in those things. And I also just noticed that usually when I'm here, I sit somewhere over here and can't really see everybody say their name, which I'm appreciating, watching everybody as they say their name. I appreciate this place very much, and I appreciate this group very much. Last time I was here, I spoke about faith, which is a troubled word in our culture, but I try to keep using it, because to me this is an atmosphere of faith, and for me, I have an experience of something I call faith, which is a quality of my experience, which I feel like I share here, like there's a quality of it that's not in me, but we share. And I do not associate faith with a conviction in something unknown. This is not my definition of faith. So my definition of faith has more to do with an inspired confidence that helps us look beyond the sort of tribulations of the moment. Somewhat optimistically, but not without wisdom or discernment. So since I talked about faith last time, I thought I would sort of delve into the notion of wisdom, which in Buddhist tradition is like a balancing factor, actually. The two sort of support each other as we develop and we develop and we develop, and then they kind of somehow meet in a place undescribable. That's the theoretical model. One of the things I wanted to talk briefly about is that I have this little thing that I'm going to put on, and I thought I would share briefly what it means, because what it represents is that I've gone through a training, so that I've studied a particular iteration of the Buddhist tradition that that I have faith in the sense that I just described. And it also means that that study includes a group of friends, that basically direct friendships and supporting relationships that help me in that training. Because that training isn't just cognitive, it's not just ideas that we've studied about the past, but it's actual practices that we share, we bounce off of each other. So that's what this represents. It represents that I'm a part of a community that has a particular iteration of practices and theories about that practice that we are refining. It's open-ended. It's an open source training. And so I'm going to put it on to represent that. So this means there are thousands of other people I know who wear these and who many of whom I respect a great deal, some of whom I have difficulty with. And that's a good thing. So so all of this is to set up context. I think that if we're going to talk about wisdom, it can, especially in the Buddhist tradition, I have some experience with other traditions, but it can start to seem so analytical that we can associate it with kind of a reified and defined way of accepting the world, which is not what it is. Initially, in Buddhism, wisdom is this thing that's called dhammavicaya, or investigation. So it's a set of theories that we investigate. So we have a conceptual framework where we say, oh, okay, let me investigate that in my experience. So it's a training that gives us a framework for observing our own experience so that we can glean something helpful about stress and the cessation of stress, which is really what the Buddha taught, and that's all, right? So that's the context, because we don't want to get into trying to... it should be logically consistent. I think that's important. So whatever theory we're going to put together should be logically consistent, but we should not confuse the logical consistency with an understanding of what is being conveyed. The logical consistency should only give us the faith to investigate further. Simply accepting an idea on logical grounds, and this is something the Buddha taught regularly, won't necessarily help you much. It won't change the attitude of your mind and give you spiritual awakening. So, it helps to have context. It helps to tap into our sense of faith and our desire for stress-free experience. And on that basis, investigate. Take the invitation to investigate. And that investigation will include a certain amount of logical, oh, does that make sense? Is this worthy of my investigation? Because I don't really want to, there's so many things I can investigate. I want to first have a sense that it has some logical consistency before I go down that road. This is one of the things that gives me faith in Buddhism. Not everything, but one of the things. One of the things is logical consistency. Or at least a degree of it. So experience is something I want to point out. That if we're going to investigate methods for stress and freedom from stress, we need to do it in a way that recognizes that we personally have the capacity to recognize our own experience. So we have to be empowered that way. And I hear myself saying that, and it sounds kind of like, just straightforward. Like, of course, I have an experience. I can recognize it. But I have to admit that moving through my life, I often overlook it. It's very simple, it's very subtle, but it's so easy to just forget. In a way, in a subtle way, we are constantly forgetting our own capacity to recognize our own direct experience. And that's why the word sati, which is mindfulness, we've all heard of mindfulness, we all do mindfulness practice, I think, literally means the quality of remembering, right? So it has connotations of remembering. And it's very specifically remembering that there is this experience. And that's like super simple at the beginning, but it has a lot of potential. And I'm going to say a few other things about experience that I just find intellectually interesting at this point. I was listening to a Fresh Air interview with an author, and I've made a note to read his book. But it had something about touch. Just all of the important ways that touch convey information to us, and how in our language touch has all these idioms like rubbing you the wrong way. So like our follicles feel completely different one direction from another. And it's just interesting that we have all these kind of little subtle capacities to take in information and then perceive them in certain ways. And like one of the things is, this is a rather funny thing, that your fingers can read Braille. And they actually did studies to find out if your genitalia could read Braille, and it can't. Yeah. So I think this is
why.
You know, I kind of intuitively knew why, and to tell the truth, I didn't listen to the whole interview, and they may have said why, but so here's why I think. Not going to speculate about why they did, and these studies were in the Netherlands, apparently, which is where these kinds of studies happen. So different parts of our bodies can be very sensitive, but it's like our mind is actually, I don't know if I want to say in the habit, but basically we have developed in such a way as organisms to use certain inputs from our senses in different ways. And apparently the fingers are used to sense minute space. And that's what we've developed, is this capacity to discern minute space with our fingers. And that's, even though our genitalia are very sensitive, that's not the way we've developed. That's not the capacity or the need that we've used that sensitivity for.
Small spaces.
Yes. So, again, this is a little bit of an aside, but it's kind of a mirror into kind of the complexity and beauty of the depth of experience that we can be sensitive to. So our ears can hear sound and like create space for us. You know, when we hear a train, we kind of have the sense of, whoa, there's space way that way and way that way. And eyes have the, you know, create the space in front of us. So we have all these ways of experience space from our bodies. And I don't know if anybody's had this experience from meditating, but like sometimes your hands feel really big. Like that happens to me, and I feel like my hands feel way bigger than the rest of my body. And just rehearing this thing from this guy talking, I realized, yeah, because the hands are little space discerners. You know, you discern the shape, the size, and things with your hands. And it's because we've developed this capacity to use our hands to manipulate things in very, very, very minute ways as humans. That's one of the things we do. So I brought this up as just an example of the interaction of mind and sense data. It's like sense data is not all created equal. It's not independent from the history of being human. And It's also not independent of our personal history. That's important. So if you do, when you learn yoga, for example, I did a yoga teacher training, and you kind of learn that your body has these memories. So I was in a car accident, and I learned that when I do these kind of big backward bends, I was in a car accident where I did some, where my head went through all the sheet metal, and my body went, my feet went, came over my head, and it was just terrible, awful thing. But I was in this position that comes out when I do these backward bends. So your body is recording a lot of, you know, a lot of ways of experiencing the world, especially for traumatic events. And so there's this notion that you can recall these traumatic events through the shape and size of your body. Doing yoga when you're in certain positions. So you think, why are you uncomfortable in this position? And it's it might actually be because of a situation in your life that is related to that particular stance, you know? And you might notice that when you meditate, like I have my meditation posture, and when I sit in this posture, I very quickly just become a bit more lucid. My mind gets a little bit more creative, a little bit less clingy, just from this position, because I meditated a lot. And there's something in this of being sensitive and recognizing experience as not separate from the sort of rest of the world and from the way in which we abide in the world. It's not something that we just have. We don't just have our perception. Our perception is in a dynamic relationship with how our body is, how people are around us. And so I just said all of that to sort of invite us into the notion that experience includes so much more than what we can define about it. That's all. And that's, again, a kind of simple thing. Our experience is always more than we can describe. So does it make sense that I would bring that up before talking about wisdom? Because the next thing we're going to do is try and describe what experience is next. We just need to have the caveat that actual experience is so much deeper, so much more nuanced. And so much more contingent. Does everybody know what contingent means? Yeah, so it's contingent. Our experience is changing all the time on a contingent basis. It's just contingent upon the way we're sitting, contingent upon all of the experiences that have come up to that moment for us, contingent upon the development of human species, contingent upon cultures colliding, and whether or not, anybody's rubbed us the wrong way this week. So it's contingent. And what Dhammavacaya does, this investigation of the Dhamma, or the Dharma, the investigation of experience, because Dharma, one of the... we hear this word Dharma, Buddha Dharma, and it can literally just mean the teaching of the Buddha. But it also means experience. And some sort of traditions of Buddhism talked about Dhammas in the plural. Like, Dhammas are like these experiences that are happening sort of in a line through our experience. So like one moment to the next is just a series of Dhammas. Not to be over-reified. That's just a way of talking. The fact is, there is experience. It's contingent, it's changing, it's flowing, it's happening. Dhamma is a word for experience. So, Dhammavacaya is an investigation of that experience so that we can be more clear about it. The Buddha postulated for us that part of the reason the stress arises is because of a misapprehension of our experience. And so if we investigate our experience in a particular manner, we're likely to come to a more lucid, clear, actual understanding of our experience. Lucid and creative in the sense that because it's contingent and changing all the time, the understanding changes with it. So it's a kind of, it's a way of being aware. And so now I'm going to talk about what that investigation is. So, or a model for ways to investigate. Now, we're actually getting to my talk now. The Buddha divided up this world of experience into five parts. So, the parts... are like a cross-section of experience. Experience moves through time. But we could say that I'm not sure if I can draw this. This is like a helix, right? I'm just going to draw this very poorly, real quickly, but 3, 4, and 5. Let's imagine a helix with five strands, you know, like a DNA is a double helix. And all these five strands are like a ribbon spinning through time. And that ribbon, so each one of these strands is actually like a thread in the ribbon, completely not independent of each other, completely contingent upon each other, right? There's a way. So the Buddha said, not in reality, but in theory, we can basically take a cross section of this, and what we get is five ways of approaching our experience that are completely the same in a certain sense. So it's just a perspective to take on experience, right? But not, you can't actually divide one of these things from the other, because they're contingent upon each other and totally woven together. And we've heard of these often. Many of you have heard of these. They're called the skandhas. And I think the skandhas are best invoked rather than telling you what they are. And they're invoked because they're a kind of way of observing experience, right? So it's sort of like if we're standing here and I say, can you hear what's behind you? I would say that what that hopefully invokes is a kind of experience of listening behind you, right? And maybe your ears even twitch. Like, so you're like, you know, because you can hear things over here, but actually your mind has this amazing capacity to kind of pick out experience and look at it in a certain way. So, in a similar manner, I could say, what's it like now? And of course, this might get you to say, well, what do you mean, what's it like? What's what like? Whatever is the object of your experience right now, what's it like? So this would be, in Buddhism, what's called rupa, or form. Sometimes called the materiality of the world. But it's also, it goes beyond that. It goes to what you could imagine. It's basically whatever shape, whatever sense data, you know, it could be redness, could be warmth, coolness, whatever. But Buddhism calls this the sort of objective side of experience, rupa, form. You might imagine it, you might see a light in your mind's eye, you might hear a sound. Whatever it is, it's form. And so it's just one way of investigating your experience. It's helpful to know we can investigate form. It's actual experience. The next one is feeling. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? This is another way of investigating, well, form, actually, in all of its sort of incredible variety. All of it is either pleasant or unpleasant, or you don't know. It's neutral. So feeling. And I ask the question, is it pleasant or unpleasant now? Again, you're not trying to answer the question. It invokes a kind of observation. What's happening now? So rather than answering the question, the mind wants to know, what is the process of perception? I could say I'm talking now, or I'm listening now. So this is perception or thought. It's sort of the paradigm of what we think. And it can be quite subtle. It shouldn't be overly thought of as like actually calling something a thing. Form, feeling, perception. Next one's interesting. What am I doing now? What am I doing now? These are things you could actually ask yourself during meditation to sort of brighten up your discernment, to make your mind look a little more clearly. What am I doing? And don't answer it, just look. What am I doing? This is known as intention or intention or compulsion. So it could be very intentional in the sense that you're really being direct about what you want. Or it could just be a kind of background compulsion. What am I doing? I'm actually just, one could be more creative and one more reactive, if that makes sense. But either what am I doing is, in a sense, the intentionality or the compulsionness of what's happening right now. The way in which you're being guided, so to speak. The direction that your mind is moving in. And traditionally this is karma or samskara. So it's I'll just say intention. It's actually one of the most interesting and difficult to define. Intention. And the last one is perhaps the most difficult to define, but what's awareness like now? And I actually think this is kind of important, that we as meditators recognize that sometimes awareness is like a spotlight, right? Like just flowing in one direction and you're just putting it on like your breath or the person you don't like or the person you really like. So attention can be like that. It can just... Or attention can be sort of like really broad and diffuse, looking outward, far, like just completely receptive. Or it can be kind of, it's mostly poetic, but it can be kind of like a glow sometimes. Like not looking for something, but sort of shining on everything. Awareness is quite interesting. And this is consciousness. I don't know if I spelled that right. So, what's awareness like now? So these are questions we can ask. What's it like now? Is it pleasant or unpleasant now? What's happening now? What am I doing now? What's awareness like now? And you can sort of do it in a way that galvanizes you to observe your experience for the purpose of the relieving of stress. There are so many ways that these questions can relieve stress that we could all give anecdotes. And that's why this talk isn't really about that. Wisdom is a general thing that we cultivate. It's in a general recognition of actual awareness as it is from different perspectives until we get to the point where we recognize the reality of things as they are in our experience. So that's it. How are we doing on time?
You got about 15, 20 minutes.
Great, well that's perfect. Any questions or comments? Let's just talk about experience now.
Yeah, thanks so much. This is terrific. How do you, in your wisdom, distinguish between consciousness and awareness? Or is that a useful distinction?
In this iteration, mm-hmm. consciousness is so woven together with these other things mm-hmm. that it's like a factor of them. So if you see red, that's redness consciousness. Now, there is iterations of the Buddhist tradition that speaks of awareness in a much different way. And this kind of consciousness, I think, is more akin to what we would call, which is kind of has bad connotations, self-consciousness or clinging consciousness. It's the consciousness that's attached to the object of its perception or of its experience, and not different from. So it posits a viewer, but it's actually not separate. So if you see redness, that's redness consciousness. If you feel unpleasantness, that's unpleasantness consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
I sure appreciate your visual representation of the five skandhas. It's something that had always, I mean, every time I've heard the word described, described in the past, or the context has been something like heaps or piles. Or something.
Right.
You know, I had a stack of pancakes in my mind, you know, for each of those. So, or you know, each of the five pancakes that makes up reality for that individual. But,
yeah.
These five interwoven strands that constitute, you know, that fly through time. It's like really wonderful.
I've never found heaps helpful either. I was reading Tanisara this morning just to get another perspective on it, who's a monk, scholar monk, and he said that the term skandhas also comes from the trunk of a tree, and that it possibly had connotations, you know, because a lot of the early Buddhist iterations had to do with the fire simile, so the burning. And it had to do, the notion was that fire burns on its object, like clinging, hatred, aversion, cling to their objects like fire. So the heaps were the actual object burning. So these things were on fire with greed, hatred, and delusion, and that's why they were basically firewood. But that didn't necessarily get, so we're trying to figure out what is a heap and why, you know, what does a log have to do with experience.
That's great. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
I had a thought as you were talking about sati as remembering, and then you mentioned trauma, which is something I've worked with a fair amount. It just made me think of dismembering as the sort of the opposite of remembering. Uh-huh. Because I think with trauma, it's kind of like a big bang where people get dismembered into a lot of pieces.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was a useful way to think about remembering.
Right.
It's kind of putting yourself back together.
Yeah, yeah. And often mindfulness practices is spoken of in terms of integration, like reintegrating. Yeah.
You know, I, you know, wisdom is seeing reality as it is, in some respect. And it seems to me, maybe you can speak to this, that really the only way to get deep wisdom is to practice ethical conduct. You know, and I see all the time, you know, that's been my experience. So, you know, when people want wisdom and they meditate and they do these other things, but they're living unethically, saying, you know, how can, you know, wisdom be a fruit of unethical living?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is your experience with the relationship between ethical conduct, which you tend to be, and wisdom seeing things as it is?
I was going to, one part of the context I was going to bring up was the three limbs of practice, one of which is ethics. You know, if our purpose is the diminishing of stress, wisdom is the seeing that stress is not owned by us, that we sort of throw it around, it just bounces around between us. And so ethics is the minimization of that. It's like, as it comes towards you, you're trying to, in a sense, not pass it around some more. So wisdom helps one see that the stress that one thinks is one's own is shared. So that's part of it. So you become more like knowledgeable about the fact that the more stress goes out, the more it comes in. I would say through my own experience, although I know that there's probably a lot of ways to meditate, that it for me, the way I've been meditating over the last 10 years, it inherently makes me more sensitive to my own behavior. I'm not going to say that's a given for everybody, but like, I was on retreat once, and I forgot to turn on the heat for the yoga room. And I remember, like, for the whole next half a day, I actually had trouble settling and feeling sort of this kind of glow of mindfulness that I often could cultivate, because a bunch of people, because I knew a bunch of people were going to be cold because of my simply forgetting to turn on the heat. So that kind of ethical sensitivity does come along with cultivating a calm mind. So meditation is both about the observation and investigation of wisdom, but it's also about the cultivation of a calm, kind, stable mind, which, when the ethics is missing, rarely arises in my personal experience. Yeah. So this investigation, when it was given, was about self, right? Like, it would, so the notion was that we would investigate all of these things to see if they were self. And I find this, I was actually having a conversation with a member of my Sangha, and he's really wrapped up in this notion of self. And I realized that I didn't have it very well defined. I don't know what he thinks self is. And this is something I wanted to bring up. Like, what do we think? I think in terms of this investigation, one, it broadens our capacity for recognition and awareness of what's actually happening. But it also, at some point, might bump up into against your idea of what yourself is. But I think, having been teaching Buddhism for around 4 or 5 years, I've just started to recognize that I don't know what people think self is. And we all have, I think this actually has to do with kind of a variation of culture, that we actually have a kind of splintered culture where different people are allowed to think different things about, you know, what their self is. Maybe that's speculation. But, you know, it's a good example, like God, too. I don't know what people think God is. Like, I realize that when I do reviews with people who do meditation classes who aren't necessarily Buddhists, and they bring it up, and I'm listening very intently because I realize I have no clue what they mean when they say God, actually. And so I have to be sensitive to that. And it's the same with self. Like, what is myself? We're all going to actually be in a kind of loose, kind of moving relationship with what we think we are. And these are actually meant to help us come to a kind of more consistent understanding of what we think ourselves are, and make our minds more lucid to that, so that we're not compelled in a negative way by it. I realized I didn't bring up self at all, since traditionally speaking, this is all about the observation of what we might think self is, and the loosening of our clinging to that. Something else might come to me, Tom.
You know, thank you for, you know, such an interesting topic. Normally, and this is just a comment, normally when we have a Dharma talk, I can relate to my practice and, you know, I end up with a very specific question that will help me, you know, explore it a little wider. And I have questions or I have interest, but I can't formulate them into specific questions. So I would say, I think what you have generated for me is fascination, you know, as opposed to, it's not confusion, it's just like this opening. Because some of what you try to put into words is somewhat indescribable. And so I find that my mind is just sort of like trying to look at it from different angles. I guess the best
good.
Question, yeah, the best question I could pose would be telling me.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Or meditate. We'll just meditate.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a different format here, but when I talked about this, I did a day here at one point, and what I did was I had people pair off and ask each other while they meditated these questions. Like, what are you doing now? and they would get a couple of minutes. And then they would ask again, what are you doing now? And they would do that, and then they would do the next question. So we'd do all the questions for about a half an hour. So this can be helpful. You take these simple questions, and you have a partner help you meditate by asking you these questions to do what you're talking about, to get your mind to sort of look in a different way. Yeah.
Listening to you and, to what you're saying, seeing you come over here on a fairly frequent basis also makes me curious if you could maybe say a few, tell us a little bit about your sangha, this building, its home base, those traditions or the kind of stuff that goes on over here other than on Sunday mornings. I'm kind of curious because I really don't know.
Thank you. So it's a Triratna Buddhist community that was the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And I think it was founded by a man in England who went from being an ordained Theravada practitioner in India to disrobing in a sense, although he never really technically disrobed, but he sort of gave up being a monk, that was for sure. It was in the 60s, so he actually just entered into the 60s London movement, and he decided actually very intentionally to start a new order because he personally felt that there were some difficult points to tradition. In a weird way, he was very traditional, but in another way, he was very traditional in his view of Buddhist practice, but very untraditional in his notion of what would work in modern society to make that practice a reality. And so he created this ordination that's completely disconnected, not completely, but mostly disconnected from other ordination lineages. We consider it a bodhisattva ordination, which actually, most Chinese Buddhists just are that. So it's actually in a sense just meaningless in a sense. Like it has no meaning. But it also has a lot of meaning in the sense that it means what I said when I got here, which is what it means is that I share a tradition of understanding of the Buddhist teaching that doesn't look anywhere at, it looks other places for inspiration from time to time, but mostly looks towards this body of practice that I share with about 4,000 other people around the world who are also ordained. And it's not centrally organized in one sense because economically it's completely independent. All the centers around the world are independent. So unlike a lot of other religious traditions, it has no central authority other than spiritual, if that makes sense. The founding teacher has authority in the sense that if we listen to him, then we listen to him. Because he's our founder. He's actually not going to live much longer. He's in his 90s. But I thought I would share that because unlike, say, the Zen tradition that actually has a hierarchical lock on who can be ordained and who can't be. Actually, I don't know how they work, to tell the truth, but I was speaking to Michael, who is a Zen priest, and he said you still have to go to Japan to become ordained. I mean, you have to go there and go through that specific training. Here, with our tradition, you can be wherever in the world. You don't have to, but your ordination does have to be okayed by a body, but it doesn't mean you have to go there to get training. So we represent a network of people who recognize each other's practice. And we recognize the value of the training that way, rather than in an institution where we get a specific training. Does that make sense? Yeah. There's a lot for me to say about that. But around here, there's about 12 order members who meet in little groups now and then. And then there's a community of other people who are entering into the training net sometimes. And we offer open classes on mindfulness. Everything from mindfulness to more staid or more traditional Buddhism we offer. So we're trying to do it all, really. Yeah.
Prasada, can you share the origin and the meaning of your name, Prasada Chitta Dharmachari?
So Dharmachari is a title. It's what I am. I'm a Dharmachari. You know, like a bhikkhu is a title for a particular thing, or Rinpoche. So Dharmachari means farer in the Dharma, Dharmachari. So that's a title. People who have these are Dharmacharis, or Dharmacharinis, if they're women. Prasada Chitta was given to me by this building's caretaker, Shantanayaka, who's a wonderful man, who's my preceptor. And he gave it to me in the course of a four-month retreat that I went on, where I got ordained. And it means clarity and conviction of the mind and heart, roughly. Chitta is mind, heart, or mental event. And prasada is like, it has connotations of prasad means like settling dust in water. That's the image of the word. Yeah. Sad actually is to settle. It actually comes from the same root.
Thanks for making what sounded like an esoteric topic wisdom tangible and something that we can think about. I noticed you used the word stress.
Yes.
And you used it a fair amount, and I'm fairly new to Buddhism, but I've heard a lot of talk about suffering and relieving suffering. Am I right that you were using stress in place of suffering? And if so,
yep.
Is that something in your... sect?
No, we say suffering.
Okay.
Or stress. I think stress is a good word because the word dukkha encompasses a lot. So I think that suffering can often make us miss the sort of the subtle dis-ease that also is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's also the other really difficult stuff. Too.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, just a point of clarification. Most often I've heard sort of the two wings or pillars of Buddhism as wisdom and compassion,
mm-hmm.
and you characterized one as faith. So, are faith and compassion in that sense related? Or?
They're two. That's true. I think, and personally, I also think they're. Faith is like the emotional element, so in that sense it's correlative with compassion, because compassion, you probably know, could also be replaced by sympathetic joy or metta or equanimity. But it's the emotional element rather than the clarity element. But there, our tradition is actually one of the central teachings that we use for guidance is called the five spiritual faculties, which is a five-pointed or four-pointed star rotating around mindfulness, with faith on one side and wisdom on the other, and energy on one side and concentration on the other. And this is a very traditional teaching that's more about the moment rather than a kind of developmental model. So at any moment, you can work to balance faith with wisdom and energy with concentration. But mindfulness is the one thing that you can't do without, if that makes sense. So you take mindfulness, but mindfulness gets raised up by all four, like in a linear manner. So five spiritual faculties, you could look that. It's not the wings. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I think we'll go ahead and end on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Okay, so it's time for announcements. I have a couple I think I'll go ahead and start with. Next week is a Dharma duo, which is actually seems to be a Dharma trio. There's going to be three Sangha members, Tom Bruin, Jay Davidson, and myself. We're presenting a talk called Compassion Off the Cushion. Buddhist teachings prepare us to respond with loving kindness and compassion. But what happens when we are in the moment dealing with others? How, for instance, do we respond to the suffering of family members such as elderly parents? How open are we to receiving help from others when we're in need ourselves? In this full Sangha discussion, we will draw from each other's real life experiences led by Tom, Jay, and Roy, who have recently spent time caring for parents in need of assistance. So that will be our topic and what we're doing next week. And if I may, we'll go into Dana. Dana is the Pali word for generosity. And we pass the Dana bowl around. We're going to ask for, if you can, give a $10 donation today. If not, whatever you can give is greatly appreciated. But the Dana bowl does help to cover the rent, our newsletter, our speakers, the Larkin Street dinners that we do once a month, and for mail, website, and other things that we do. So it would be great if you could help us out with that. And with that said, if we can hear from our host.
Sure. Please help yourself. There's snacks. And if you want, to help yourself to some tea, just go ahead and place your cup in soapy water and we'll rinse them out at the end. There's also a mailing list. And at the end, around 12:30, we all get together and meet if you'd like to join us for lunch. And I'll be coming out of the Dana bowl.
Thank you. Jess?
I'm the coordinator of hosts, and right now we have an opening. We ask our hosts to make a commitment of one Sunday every 2 months, and right now we're short. We have an opening on one of those dates, so if anybody's interested in contributing to the song in that way, please see me during the social hour.
Thank you, Cass. Anyone else? Okay, let's stand for the dedication of merit, please.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for your practice today, gentlemen. Enjoy your Sunday.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.